My welcome to that of Matt. My name is Richard. Going to be reading the Bible first of all for us, and we're reading from John's Gospel, chapter 11, the first 46 verses. John chapter 11, and I invite you to listen very carefully. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." "But, Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light." After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us go also, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. But Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she told him. "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." Then after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Indeed, you need a Bible. We're going to be looking at John chapter 11. We'll be looking our way through. We've been working our way through the first 12 chapters of John's Gospel, and we come to really what is a great climax. And we're going to study most of John chapter 11. It's on page 760 in the Church Bibles. John chapter 11, page 760, and I invite you to pray with me now. Our Father, help us to be still, to listen carefully to the words of this Gospel. Help us to understand these words, and especially to see Jesus more clearly. Enable us and put in us the desire to respond in trust and obedience, and we ask for Jesus' sake. Amen. Strap yourselves in, get ready. It is an amazing journey that we go on in this chapter. And we need to give it all our full attention. Well, if you look up the entry for the term conditional sentence in Wikipedia, you'll find on that page that one of the headings is entitled counterfactual. And that section begins as follows. Quote, in a counterfactual or speculative conditional sentence, a situation is described as dependent on a condition that is known to be false or presented as unlikely. The time frame of the hypothetical situation may be past, present, or future, and the time frame of the condition does not always correspond to that of the consequence. For example, if I were king, I could have thrown you in the dungeon. If I won the lottery, I would buy a car. If he said that to me, I would run away. If you had called me, I would have come. If you had done your job properly, we wouldn't be in this mess now. Unquote. And so we come today to one of the greatest, most heartfelt, most anguished counterfactuals ever uttered. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Having worked our way through John's Gospel so far, and from what we now learn of Jesus' close relationship to this family, we can easily affirm, yes, that statement is true. And yet, what happens after this statement has been made, first by Martha and then by Mary, shows in the most spectacular way imaginable how it completely misses the point. In fact, if you think the key question posed by this chapter is, why doesn't Jesus just heal Lazarus? Or more bluntly, why does Jesus let Lazarus die? I would say rather that the key question posed by this chapter, and indeed the question that this chapter is designed to answer, is, why does Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead? So now let's get into chapter 11. Over this series, we've looked at a number of incidents in the gospel that John calls signs. And we've looked at a number of the I am statements made by Jesus. And we've seen a case where a sign and an I am statement are joined together. That was in chapter 9, where Jesus heals the man born blind after he says for the second time, I am the light of the world. The sign and the I am statement work together in that case. Chapter 11 does the same thing. Jesus says one of his I am sayings and then gives a sign that directly relates to that saying. So the plan for the rest of the sermon is as follows. First, I'll do a plot summary. Then, because they're important, I'll say more about some of the details of the plot. But then I want to look at the sign itself, what it demonstrates, how Jesus explains its significance, why Jesus gives the sign, and then what is its fulfillment. And last, draw out a few points of application. First, the plot. But actually, before considering the plot, we have to work out geographically where we are and where we're going, because journeys play an important part in the story. Can you remember way back to when I spoke on John chapter 1 that I mentioned in John's gospel, there are two different places that are both called Bethany, and I'm sure Bethany remembers it. I think I was actually looking at Bethany when I said it. In chapter 1, Jesus is baptized by John the Baptist in what I'll call Bethany number 1. Bethany on the other side of the Jordan, that is on the east side of the Jordan. In chapter 11, we're now introduced to Bethany number 2. This Bethany is southeast of Jerusalem. Verse 8 very conveniently tells us how far away from Jerusalem it is. Even more helpfully, the NIV's footnote to verse 18. Have a look. 15 stadia, about 3 kilometres. So Bethany number 2, the Bethany next to Jerusalem, we know exactly where it is. It's on the southeast slope of the Mount of Olives. At the beginning of chapter 11, Jesus is where he was at the end of chapter 10. He's back in Bethany number 1, the Bethany on the east side of the Jordan. So now it actually becomes important to know more precisely where that is. And unfortunately, it's not certain. To keep things simple, I'm going to take the option of the place that's now called Al-Magtas. The name Al-Magtas is Arabic for baptism, or the place of the baptism. The place itself is just over the east side of the Jordan, about 9 kilometres north of the northern limit of the Dead Sea. There are other possibilities for this place, most notably the region of Bethania, which is just east of the Sea of Galilee up in the north. And that is, for example, Don Carson's view, and in his commentary he works through the important implications that that would have on this story. If it turns out he's right, then I would agree with how he works out those implications. And for those of you who really are paying attention, the previous sentence is a predictive conditional sentence. But let's stick with Al-Magtas for Bethany number 2. In that case, the distance between the two Bethanies is about 40 kilometres, one day's journey each way. Keep that in mind. Now to the plot itself. Here's the plot summary. Jesus has some very dear friends who live in Bethany number 2, near to Jerusalem. They're 3 siblings, Lazarus and his 2 sisters, Martha and Mary. Lazarus gets sick. The 2 sisters send Jesus a message telling him this. Jesus stays 2 more days in Bethany number 1. Then, together with his disciples, he takes the one-day journey to Bethany number 2. Lazarus has now been dead 4 days. Martha is the first of the sisters to meet Jesus. She has a very important conversation with Jesus. Then she goes back to the house and tells her sister Mary to go out to meet Jesus. Mary goes out to meet Jesus together with a group of people and has a conversation with Jesus. They take him to the tomb. Everybody's now at the tomb. Jesus asks for the tomb to be opened. Martha objects, but Jesus insists. The tomb is opened. Jesus calls out to Lazarus to come out of the tomb. Lazarus comes out of the tomb alive. This causes a division amongst the witnesses. Many believe in Jesus. Some go off to tell the Pharisees about what happened. As a 201-word summary, I'm pretty happy with it. And yet, it's completely obvious how inadequate it is. To be specific, the logic of the story is utterly dependent on all of the details John gives us. We don't have time to discuss all of them, and it hurts so much. I'll go over just a few of the details, particularly where the wording of our NIV can trip us up. Follow with me as we go through this chapter. First, verse 4. When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death." Jesus doesn't mean that Lazarus is not going to die. In fact, Jesus knows full well that Lazarus is going to die, but that Lazarus' death will not be the end of the story. It's even possible that when Jesus says this, he knows that Lazarus is already dead. The rest of verse 4 says this, "No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." At this point, John has simply put his cards on the table because this statement of Jesus is actually the key to the whole chapter. But let's imagine for now we put those cards back in John's hand for the moment and keep going. The point that John has made so far in this chapter is that Jesus already knows what's going to happen. It's very important to affirm that the unfolding of the events does not take Jesus by surprise. If you could meet John and you were to say to him that in this chapter you find Jesus to be callous, cold, or calculating, John would say to you, "No, you've missed it." In this chapter, Jesus is determined. He is resolute. And he has a much bigger perspective on events than you give him credit for. Verses 5 and 6. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. The word "yet" at the beginning of verse 6 suggests that Lazarus stays where he is despite the fact that he loves Lazarus. Well, the NIV editors were having a bad day when they chose that wording. The conjunction at the beginning of verse 6 is not "yet," it is "therefore" or "so." And the 2011 NIV has fixed this up. If you read the 2011 NIV, you will see verses 5 to 7 now read like this. "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days, and then he said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.'" Do you see the point? Jesus stays where he is precisely because of his love for Lazarus and his sisters, not in spite of his love for them. I think we're supposed to be shocked by this, or at least very surprised. But at least we should now be thinking that something is going on here. Something that is going to transform our very understanding of love. In the following verses, Jesus discusses the situation with his disciples. And there's yet another trademark misunderstanding. Jesus says, "Lazarus is asleep." His disciples think he means literal sleep, but Jesus is speaking euphemistically, using what was then a perfectly common way of speaking about death. And because they misunderstand, Jesus has to tell them plainly. That brings us to verses 14 and 15. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Once again, we get a hint. Something's going on. Jesus is glad. He rejoices. Not that Lazarus is dead, but for his disciples' sake. Jesus already knows how this is going to turn out, and he knows that this will benefit his disciples. Let's now skip to the key conversation of the chapter. Martha has learned that Jesus is coming into the village, so she leaves the house to meet him. Verses 21 and 22. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. In verse 22, where Martha says, I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask, she's not suggesting to Jesus that he might raise Lazarus, let alone prodding him to do so. She has no idea that's even possible, let alone that Jesus is actually planning to do it. And in case there is any doubt of that, it's confirmed by what she says later. First in this conversation, later on, and then at the tomb, where she actually tries to talk Jesus out of having the stone taken away. No, John intends us to take what Martha says quite plainly. It's a statement of how much she trusts Jesus. She knows Jesus would have been able and willing to heal Lazarus from his sickness. And although she now has to mourn his death, this has not in any way changed her faith in Jesus, one bit. That's what verse 22 means. And at this, I have to stop and say, wow. One hears so frequently of people who've professed some level of faith in God in general, or in Christianity in particular, who then experience the loss of a family member or a close friend, and this experience leads them to give up their faith in God. It is so sad to hear when that happens. And I wonder, particularly for those who had claimed to be Christian, just how well they had read their Bibles, or at least had been taught the gospel message. Had they been taught John chapter 11? Wow, Martha. Your faith in Jesus is a remarkable testimony. Your faith has been tested to the limit, and you're holding up. Very soon, your faith is going to be rewarded. And you know what? The greatest part of Martha's reward is not that she gets her brother back. Her great reward is that through what happens, her faith in Jesus will be increased. Well, for that to happen, Jesus has to lay some groundwork. He has to get her ready to understand the significance of what she is going to see. So verse 23, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." What a thing to say. From our perspective, having read through the whole chapter, verse 23 is a doozy. And it's not the first time in John's gospel that Jesus has said something that on the surface has one meaning, but that we can see has a double meaning. Remember what Jesus said to Nicodemus back in chapter 3, that no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again. And how that has a double meaning. Here, Jesus is gently leading Martha on. Jesus says to her, "Your brother will rise again." And what did Mary hear? Something she already knows perfectly well, and she says as much. Verse 24, Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Yes, indeed. Martha says what every believing Jew of her day knew. Well, not quite everyone. Which Jewish sect didn't believe in the resurrection on the last day? Sadducees, thank you, some people still awake. In the other Gospels, we can read how Jesus gives the Sadducees quite a serve for that reason, that they do not believe in the resurrection. Martha and her family are not members of the Sadducees. Martha believes in the resurrection of all people that will happen on the last day, the day of judgment. Good. Jesus can build on that belief. Jesus is going to build on that belief. And he'll do that in a way we've already seen several times before in John's Gospel. So verse 25, Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life." Bam. I'm quite sure that Martha was not expecting that. What's going on? Martha's belief in the resurrection is good as far as it goes. It just doesn't go anywhere near far enough. Her belief is too vague, too unspecific, too distant from her own situation. Jesus is transforming and enhancing Martha's belief by making it personal, deeply personal, personal in terms of Jesus' role in resurrection, and personal in terms of what Martha must herself come to believe. The rest of verse 25 explains resurrection, and the beginning of verse 26 explains life. So let's look at those verses now in full. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Let's unpack that. First, Jesus is the resurrection in this sense. The one who believes in Jesus will live, even though they die. In chapter 11, Jesus does precisely nothing about the certainty of physical death. Human mortality has remained at 100%. But Jesus is saying that, nevertheless, there is life that transcends physical death for all who believe in him. There will be a resurrection to life for all who believe in the one who is the resurrection. Second, Jesus is the life in this sense. Whoever lives and believes in Jesus will never die. To put that in other words, everyone who has this life that Jesus is talking about, the life in the age to come, the kingdom of God, who believes in Jesus shall continue in that life forever, not experiencing death. For the one who believes in Jesus, the life in the age to come is something you possess and have an experience of now. And that life continues through physical death. The consequences of that for how to live now aren't worked out here in chapter 11. That comes later in John's Gospel. But once again, all these promises are based on Jesus' identity. Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life." And as before, that also means no one and no thing else is. To have the life Jesus is speaking about, you must believe in Jesus. That's why Jesus asks Martha explicitly in verse 26, "Do you believe this?" And John wants every reader of his gospel to ask this question of themselves, and so I ask it of you. Do you believe this? Well, Martha's answer ranks as one of the all-time great statements of Christian faith. Verse 27, "Yes, Lord," she told him, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. "Yes, Martha, you got it. That's right." And yet, she still hasn't clicked to what's going to happen at the tomb. What happens at the tomb will give her confession of faith a profound clarity, which it does not yet have. And that is what Jesus is doing in this conversation and will do later. Did you notice while I was doing the Bible reading that Mary greets Jesus with the same statement? Verse 32, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." But Mary is completely overwrought. She falls at Jesus' feet and she's weeping, together with the people who've come with her, among whom are almost certainly the usual professional mourners, making a very loud noise. Mary's grief has clouded her vision. It's not wrong to feel deep emotion, of course not. But this is too much. Not only does Mary say nothing like the affirmation of continuing faith that we heard from Martha, in fact, the grief of Mary and her companions seems to be so profound that it calls into question whether they share Martha's belief in resurrection at all. And so, what is Jesus' response to all this commotion? Verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And our NIVs, as I must say, basically every English translation since Tyndale, fail to do justice to Jesus' response. The nearest I found to what's going on is found in the footnote in the ESV, which says that Jesus was indignant. Jesus was angry, and he became very agitated. What at? Well, two possibilities, I think. Either he's angry at the commotion itself, or at what has really caused it. Here we see the outworking of the power and the consequences of sin in the world, that is death. And Jesus is angry because it causes so much havoc. So in this situation, where is their hope? They don't seem to have any. The very one who is the resurrection and the life is standing right in front of them. And all their noise and extreme emotion is a denial of that fact. Similarly, in verse 35, we read, Jesus wept. But why? Those who saw Jesus weeping thought they knew. Verses 36 and 37. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" These statements are extraordinary for both being simultaneously true as statements and dead wrong as explanations. First, Jesus did love Lazarus. But that's not why Jesus is crying. His tears are for them because of their unbelief, not for Lazarus. Second, Jesus could have kept Lazarus from dying. But like Martha and Mary's first statements when they met Jesus, it misses the point. Jesus is going to raise Lazarus. And this will turn out to be a far greater thing. Well, after all that, I don't actually need to say very much about the actual raising of Lazarus. John presents it in quite a matter-of-fact way, though, of course, it is an absolutely stunning event in the history of the world. We've actually now done as much of the hard work of understanding the details of the text as we need to do. So now I'm going to say something about this sign as a sign. First, note simply that the raising of Lazarus is one of the signs given by Jesus and recorded for us by John in his gospel. At this point, quoting myself is a bit odd, but hey, I think I got this right. Back in January, when I spoke about the healing of the servant's son, this is what I said about that sign. Quote, "The sign is a physical reality that points to a spiritual reality. How does Jesus perform the sign? He speaks. In this case, Lazarus come out. The word who in the beginning was with God, the word who is God, the word in whom is life, Jesus utters a word of life. What's the physical reality? There is healing. There is life. What's the spiritual reality that the sign points to? Jesus. Jesus is the one who has power over life." Unquote. Second, in its demonstration of Jesus' power over life and death, the sign gives glory to the Son of God. That is verse 4. I'll read it again. "It is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Third, the sign's meaning is explained by Jesus, especially for Martha. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. For Martha, and yes, for us, it is absolutely essential to grasp this revelation of verses 25 and 26 in order to understand the sign. Fourth, the sign is given so that you may believe. Verse 15 again. "And for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe." The end of verse 26. "Do you believe this?" Verse 27. "Yes, Lord, I believe." Verse 45, which I'll read in the 2011 NIV so you can see how this is the same idea. "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him." But there are specific beliefs called for. Have a look at Jesus' prayer at the tomb in verses 41 and 42. "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." And Martha's confession isn't a generic statement, "I believe," either. Her belief is even more specific. So verse 27 again, she told him, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." And this belief is not an end in itself. This belief leads to life. We haven't looked at it very often during this series, but it's good to remind ourselves from time to time of John's own statement of why he wrote this gospel. We find it in chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. I'll read it for us now. "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Fifth, this sign doesn't stop pointing in this chapter. It points even further forward to the end of John's gospel. It finds its ultimate fulfillment in the ultimate glorification of Jesus, which, as we saw at Easter, means in John's gospel, Jesus' own death and resurrection. And we get hints of that early on in the chapter, verses 7 and 8. "Then he said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.' 'But Rabbi,' they said, 'a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there?' Indeed, Jesus goes back to Judea to perform this sign, less than 3 kilometres from Jerusalem." And then verse 16, "Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, 'Let us go, let us also go, that we may die with him.'" Die with whom? With Jesus. Thomas expects this trip to end in Jesus and the disciples' death. Well, the trip to Bethany doesn't end in their death, but it does directly lead to the meeting of the Sanhedrin that decides to plot to take Jesus' life. We're going to look at that next week. So, what about us? Well, first, what happens to Lazarus and his sisters? is actually quite confronting. One has to acknowledge that. To some, perhaps to some of us, it may even seem cruel. But the text clearly asserts and demonstrates that what happened was for their benefit and for the benefit of the others who saw the sign. And so it was. Can we accept this? Second, we've seen from Jesus' example how God's timing isn't always worked out the way we expect or want. We may perceive a delay in God acting, but such a delay is not in any way a contradiction of God's love for us. This chapter has given us a glimpse of God's divine perspective on time. The one who created time itself has mastery over it, and he makes everything beautiful in its time. Third, Jesus has shared with us one of the deepest of human experiences, the death of a beloved friend. He's seen up close what it does to people. Never doubt that Jesus truly understands our deepest feelings, our deepest emotions. Fourth, be assured that Jesus has sovereign power of life over life and death. His promise in chapter 11 is nothing less than the renewing of everything that he has made. Remember the words of the prologue of John's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. Chapter 11 has winners and a loser. The loser is death. Death's reign will not last. But those who believe in Jesus will live, even though they die. Last, the end of today's text shows yet another one of the decision points in John's Gospel. Many believe in Jesus. Some go to tell the Pharisees, and we know from previous chapters that means they have it in for Jesus. What will you do? Will you, with Thomas and the other disciples, go with Jesus where he leads? Jesus says to us, I am the resurrection and the life. But then asks us also, do you believe this? Martha's generic belief in resurrection was not enough. She had also to confess Jesus' authority over her life and his power to bring her safely into the age to come. Do you believe this? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. You betcha. But Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Will you pray with me? Our Father, thank you again for John's Gospel, and thank you for revealing to us that the Lord Jesus is himself resurrection and life. Thank you for this demonstration of his power over life and death, the raising of Lazarus. We continue to give Jesus, your Son, all the glory, a reflection of the glory that he has. Thank you that in seeing Jesus, we see the one who gives life now and the one who will raise us up on the last day. Help us each day to keep following Jesus, to remain in his word, to live out our new life in obedience and devotion. And we ask for Jesus' sake. Amen.